An imprisoned alchemist, a luxury-loving, woman-chasing duke, a host of scheming courtiers, the race for a secret formula. Sounds like the trappings of a romantic work of fiction, right? Wrong! These are, in fact, key elements in the birth of one of the most glorious industries of early modern Europe, that of Meissen porcelain. To this day, in the opinion of many, 18th century Meissen porcelain remains unsurpassed in its beauty and quality. Who can imagine the intrigue and tragedy which begat such sublime creations? Joining us today to chronicle the rise of Meissen is the art historian and author, Ms. Janice Gleason. Ms. Gleason is the author of the recent book, The Arcanum, The Extraordinary Story. And extraordinary it is indeed. Welcome, Ms. Gleason.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, today, as you know, we take porcelain or china for granted. We have dinnerware, knickknacks, even bathtubs made out of porcelain. Why was porcelain considered white gold in the early 18th century?
Well, the thing was that at the time, the only true porcelain available to Europeans was imported from China and Japan. And the substance had been named by Marco Polo after a Portuguese word, which was porcelana, which meant pig, or a vaguely sort of pig-shaped shell. And people were fascinated with the substance, firstly because there was nothing like it in Europe, and because also it was so full of contradictions. It was a substance that did look a bit like a shell because it was semi-translucent. It was non-porous, which meant it was very, very good for drinking tea and coffee and chocolate out of, which were all drinks that had just become fashionable. And yet the amazing thing about it was that it was incredibly strong.
And why weren't the Europeans making their own porcelain?
Well, they tried, but the Chinese and the Japanese, who also knew how to make it, were very, very reluctant to share their knowledge with the Western world, because they had this hugely lucrative trade and export, and, you know, why spoil it? So various entrepreneurs and rulers had tried their best to discover it, but the key to the substance was firstly the right ingredients, which turned out to be a type of clay called kaolin, or China clay, with that, you needed feldspar or some sort of a flux that would melt and fuse with the clay to make this glassy, semi-vitrified substance. But the main thing you needed was a very, very high temperature. And none of our kilns at the time had ever reached such a high temperature. So it was really quite a complex process that no one in Europe had yet mastered.
And porcelain was also very expensive and very treasured by the wealthy. And who were the leaders in this porcelain mania that you describe?
Well, they tended to be the sort of fashion setters of the time, the trend setters. And just like nowadays, where we read the glossy magazines about rich people who set fashions, in those days it tended to be rulers and noblemen and very wealthy entrepreneurs. And one of the key collectors of the time was Augustus the Strong, the ruler of Saxony, who was so mad on porcelain that he said it was like oranges. You could never have enough of either one. And in fact, he went to such extremes with his porcelain collection that at one point he swapped a squadron of dragoon guards for a collection of porcelain because he thought that was a good deal.
So Augustus the Strong is very much a lover of ceramics, a lover of porcelain. He's also a lover of gold, and this is where Friedrich Böttger comes into the story. How did he get involved in gold and porcelain?
Well, Friedrich Böttger, who's sort of the hero of the story in a way, was a young apothecary when the story begins, and he was apprenticed to an apothecary in Berlin and studying madly. But during the time he was an apprentice, he became sidetracked by the subject of alchemy, and in particular he became very, very intrigued in the search for the Philosopher's Stone. And this was a substance which everybody thought at the time, if you could just find the secret formula or arcanum, you would be able to turn base metal into gold and also make yourself immortal. And Böttger became completely convinced that this was a possibility, and started doing experiments on the side and putting on sort of magic shows, which convinced people that he really did know the secret of turning metal into gold, although, of course, it was all a bit of a trick, a bit of a David Copperfield illusion. But the shows were so convincing that the ruler of Prussia, where he was studying, decided to send for him, and he was very worried about being caught out, so he escaped into the neighbouring state of Saxony, where Augustus heard about him and had him imprisoned and brought to Dresden and thrown into prison at the age of 20 and threatened with being beheaded if he couldn't actually produce gold.
And was he able to produce gold?
Well, of course, he wasn't able to produce gold, but on the way, while he was doing his frantic experiments, he became friendly with another nobleman called Baron Tischenhaus, who was involved in experiments into discovering the secret of porcelain. And because Böttger had done extensive experiments into heating minerals, he did have a lot of knowledge in that field. And so he decided that if he spent a bit of time working on the porcelain formula, it might help spare his neck, because he wasn't having much success with discovering how to make gold.
And was Augustus the Strong amenable to this?
Well, he was, because Augustus Strong, as we've said, was a great porcelain lover, and he was also desperately trying to emulate Louis XIV of France, who'd sort of set himself up as this great patron of the arts, and his country was producing all sorts of different industries, and most of the rulers at the time were very, very keen to encourage local industry, firstly to make themselves prosperous, but also because it was something of a status symbol.
And how did Böttger actually find the arcanum for porcelain at last?
Well, I think it was really through trial and error and very, very rigorous experimentation. And the records state that he had clay from every clay pit in the land. Samples of clay were sent to him, and just literally from heating them, different mixtures, different temperatures, and recording each of these experiments, eventually he managed to narrow it down and find a form of porcelain which wasn't perfect to begin with, because he in fact fused the kaolin with alabaster instead of feldspar, which was later used. And so this gave a sort of yellowish tinge to the porcelain, but it was still a vitrified substance that was recognizably porcelain.
And he was able to devise kilns that were able to fire these properly.
Yes, he realized that temperature was crucial, I think because of his work with gold. And so he was able to develop his own kilns, because nothing at that point had been developed which was capable of such high temperatures. And to begin with, these kilns were tiny, so only very, very small pieces could be made. But as the technique was perfected, larger ones were built, and then larger things like dinner plates and vases and larger sculptures were able to be fired.
So the Meissen factory develops, and what kinds of challenges did the factory face in its early years?
Well, I think it faced immense challenges. I mean, there was, first of all, the problem of corruption, because everybody saw it as a way of getting rich quickly, and whether you were the local guard on the door or the supervisor, everyone wanted to have their finger in the till. And there was also an endless sort of stream of people from neighboring princedoms and states, very happy to pay off anyone who would share a bit of knowledge with them. And then, as well as that, there was the poor old Böttger, who was still stuck in prison for most of his life. And by the end of it, by the age of mid-30s, he'd suffered from serious depression. He'd turned to drink. His eyesight had been damaged by the glare from all these experiments. He'd been poisoned by toxic fumes, and really he was in a very, very poor way indeed. And he also talked too much, because he was so miserable, and crucially told people who took the secret elsewhere. And also, I mean, there were huge technical problems to surmount. Although they discovered how to make a porcelain body, it wasn't perfect. As I said, they were using alabaster, which gave the porcelain a sort of yellowish color, which they didn't particularly like. And they had enormous difficulties in trying to discover how to decorate it, because colored enamels were another great technical hurdle.
Was Meissen able to keep the arcanum for porcelain a secret?
Well, no. They were very, very keen to try and keep it a secret, obviously, because When they first discovered it, they had this amazing monopoly throughout Europe. But, you know, there was a huge sort of skullduggery and espionage, and just basically people who were very, very unhappy with the way they were treated. And gradually the secret got out, so that within 20 years, I mean, there were about a dozen or more factories who were all producing porcelain.
And what do you think were the most fantastic pieces created at Meissen?
Well, to me, the most amazing things were the pieces made for the Japanese palace, which was Augustus the Strong's sort of showpiece palace he had built in Dresden. And on the first floor, he decided that he would have a whole porcelain menagerie. So he commissioned a worker called Candler to make a series of life-size and almost life-size animals and birds. And these objects are absolutely incredible. Some of them are 3 foot or more high. And they still exist today in museums. And although many of them are flawed because it was very difficult to make such massive pieces of porcelain, they are incredible.
And there were also some massive service settings as well, weren't there?
Yes, they made enormous service settings. I mean, thousands of pieces strong. When after Augustus the Strong died, his son took over the kingdom of the Electorate of Saxony, and he wasn't particularly interested in porcelain, so he got his prime minister called Count Bruhl in to look after the factory. And he was very keen on porcelain, and he commissioned a wonderful service called the Swan Service, which has more than 2,000 pieces in it, and each object is based on the theme of water. Because the word Bruhl means marshy ground, so it's got shells and swans and fish and all sorts of wonderful imagery on it.
Well, over the years, of course, the personnel would change at Meissen, and how did that influence the look of Meissen porcelain?
Well, very greatly, and so the factory, in the period covered by my book, it goes through very distinct phases. First of all, you have the Butzke period, where the pieces were very small and imperfect. And then there's the arch-villain of the story, a man called Herold, who arrives from Vienna and manages to sort of inveigle his way into power. And he was a very corrupt and venal man, but he was a brilliant artist, and he really managed to surmount the problem of colouring. And under him, the painted decoration, which the factory made, just achieved incredible heights of perfection. And you get the beautiful flowers, the oriental designs, harbour scenes, animals. I mean, the range is absolutely wonderful. And then when Augustus the Strong got a bit fed up with Herold's painted decoration and wanted more sculptural forms, this man called Candler arrives. And gradually the painting becomes simpler, but the sculptural designs become incredibly elaborate. So you get teapots in the shape of cockerels and the most wonderful shapes and forms. And the thing we associate most with Meissen, of course, which is the little figurines that Candler actually made originally, not to stick on your mantelpiece, but to decorate the center of great big banquet tables.
So would you consider Meissen a trendsetter or a trend follower in porcelain design?
Well, to begin with, it was very much following the Oriental lead, because that was the established market, and they felt they had to rival what China and Japan were doing. But gradually, as they became more proficient, they themselves set trends and fashions, and so much so that really the Meissen factory dominated the whole of porcelain made in Europe for probably the first three quarters of the 18th century.
And apart from this being just a really interesting story of the Arcanum, what is the significance of this story to the history of chemistry and to European history and European industry?
Well, I think that it sort of represents a turning point in industry, because suddenly you have this factory which at its height was employing more than 500 people, and they were all intensely specialized workers. You know, one man specialized in painting roses, somebody else specialized in painting the little sword on the bottom, somebody else did harbor scenes. And so really it's the beginning of specialized industry as we know it today. And the other amazing thing, I think, about it is that the formula that they discovered then has really hardly been changed, and the porcelain that the Meissen factory still turns out is basically the same substance as that made, you know, in the early 18th century.
All right, well, thank you, Ms. Gleason.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Okay, we have been talking with Ms. Janet Gleason, author of The Arcanum, The Extraordinary Story.